Lodge, 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Testimony began today in Alec Baldwin's involuntary manslaughter trial. Prosecutor Erlinda Johnson questioned crime scene technician Marissa Popple.
How many rounds altogether did you discover that you thought were suspected live rounds on the set of Rust?
Five and the spent casing, so six in total.
Baldwin charged in the death of cinematographer Helena Hutchins, who was killed when Baldwin fired a prop gun loaded with live ammunition. Vermont Senator Peter Welch called on President Biden to withdraw from the 2024 race, becoming the first Senate Democrat to do so. Former Trump fixer Michael Cohen asking the Supreme Court to revive his lawsuit, accusing the former president and some Trump administration officials of retaliating against him when he sought release from federal prison. Dangerous weather in the Northeast, tornadoes touching down in western New York about 40 miles southwest of Buffalo. This is ABC News.
I'm James Kelly with WBZH News, your news roundup in quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WBZH website at buzzofthenorth.com.
Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Protesters are out with their plans for a parade near the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee. Here's Stuart J. Waddles.
The Coalition to March on the RNC 2024 will begin their demonstration at Red Arrow Park, crossing the Milwaukee River four times and then entering the soft security zone. Organizers say the march, scheduled for noon on Monday, aims to bring protesters as close as legally possible to the convention while respecting court-ordered boundaries. I'm Stuart J. Waddles.
Expanded Amtrak service in Wisconsin is a hit with passengers. More than 18,500 people rode the Borealis trains between St. Paul and Chicago during its first month. That's about 300 passengers on each trip. Wisconsin's transportation secretary calls the data promising. And that's what you need to know. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
As a network, we're called Civic Media because a big part of it is we want to start modeling how civic discourse really should happen and being respectful of each other's opinions, even if you disagree, you know, like they should be given a platform.
If Rocker and I can get along, right. We can all get along.
I know,
along.
Exactly.
Right,
yeah.
Rocker?
Yeah, that's right, Jimmy.
Well, you do have a wall in between the two of you, so
glass.
It's like the
it's only glass.
It's only
glass.
Tear down the walls. Listen to Max Inc. Saturday night, 6 to midnight, across the Civic Media Radio Network.
This is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Going to start off with what everybody's talking about, which is, should Joe Biden step aside? Should he resign? Should he relinquish the nomination to someone else? And look, everywhere, it's the talk everywhere. And as I said from the beginning, I do believe that Joe Biden will make what is in the best interest of the country. I do believe he will make that choice. As I've said, I think, judging from what we saw on that Thursday night debate, that there's something going on there that maybe we need to evaluate. What's interesting is since all of this, this has come up, we've seen a little bit more fire out of Joe. And I said from the beginning, I go, look, you know, there was the day after. I said, you know, he's getting his Irish up. He's getting a little motivated. He's getting a little angry. And maybe that's good. Because here's the thing. I want Joe Biden as president. I've said this multiple times. I have supported Joe Biden throughout the entire administration. I have been thrilled about the things that he has accomplished. I've been supportive of all of that all along the way. Joe Biden is my guy. He is the union guy. He is the best president on union working class issues of my lifetime. Hands down, without question. Evidently, like I said, found Obama's comfortable shoes and found a picket line. That is a big freaking deal. My problem and this is where I've had to explain to a lot of listeners and viewers, my problem is presidential politics come down to a handful of voters in a handful of states. I will vote for Joe Biden no matter what. But Joe Biden's got to go out there and prove to those handful of voters in those handful of states that he's the guy. He's got to go out there and show that fire. He's got to go out there and show that he's capable to take on Donald Trump. What we saw on that Thursday, I'm sorry, there is no world where that guy is able to take on Donald Trump. And I know all the rhetoric around, well, you know, he tried to answer the questions. Yeah, that doesn't matter. Those debates are much more about appearance than they are about substance, and always, always have been. They've always been about who got the one-liner in. They're always about, you know, that memorable moment. Well, the memorable moment was 90 minutes of Joe Biden struggling. And that's a problem, again, for those handful of voters in a handful of states. But if he comes out like he did in Philadelphia, like he did here locally in Harrisburg on Sunday, like he's done in other places with that little bit of fire, get that gleam back in his eye, get that bounce a little bit in his step, then maybe you win some of them back. If he cannot do that, and look, there's a moment where you just have to realize there are things you cannot do. I know I'm never going to be able to do the things that I did when I was 20 years old. And Joe's got to understand that this is a proving moment. Yeah, he's got a great record. And would love to hear him go out there and tout that record. But sadly, what we saw on that Thursday is he couldn't deliver the punchline. And he's got a lot of great punchlines. So if he can't deliver the punchline, you need somebody who can. Because what the Democratic record has been is fabulous. There is a lot there to go, hey, look at this. Oh, did you see this? Hey, how about those jobs that are being created through the CHIPS bill? How about all that investment through the infrastructure bill? How about the green energy jobs in these factories that are being built? How about all of that stuff, the lives that are being made better? There are so many good stories here. But you got to be able to go and tell them. Now, there's part of me that goes, you know, Biden's going to hold on to this as long as he can. Because look, 2016, he was kind of pushed aside where he should have been the guy. He should have been the person who was the nominee. Instead, the party wanted Hillary Clinton. And we see what happened then. Would Joe Biden have done any better than Hillary? We don't know. And I'm not going to say he would have. But in his mind, he's got to be a little, you know, you're not going to push me out. Now, the thought is will he see? Will he be convinced? We'll see. I have faith in Joe Biden. I have faith in that he's a decent dude. I have faith that he loves this country. I have faith that he will do what is in the best interest of the country. Now, again, what's interesting to me is all the calls for Joe to step aside, none really. Here and there, a spattering. None from the corporate-controlled mainstream media about getting Trump to resign or step aside with his abysmal record. And the reason for that is, like I said yesterday, is that's who the Republicans are. I'm sorry, you obviously can't expect decency from them or from him. And this is why on the left, why Democrats, why people like me go, yeah, I think it's time. I'm curious your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Do you think it's time that Joe steps aside and passes the mantle on, passes the torch to the next generation to pick that up and tout his record in a way that it should be? Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. When we come back, Will Bunch is going to be here from the Philadelphia Inquirer. Remember that Project 2025 thing we've been talking about for almost ever? It's finally caught fire. And we're going to talk to Will about that. Quick break. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I've been hearing a lot of this lately. It's been around for a while, this idea that, you know, we're a republic, we're not a democracy. But I've been hearing a lot of this lately, especially, you know, the last couple of weeks ramping up. But Senator Mike Lee from Utah tweeted out, "We're a constitutional republic, not a democracy." And again, I've been hearing this a lot, you know, like there's a huge difference. It's kind of like, you know, I drive a vehicle, not a car. It's kind of the same mentality, but I have this theory that they want us to be okay with losing democracy because, of course, we're this other thing. And here to share some thoughts on, are we this other thing? And should we chuck democracy? I've asked our good friend Will Bunch to come talk with us. Will is a columnist over at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Will, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, hey, Rick, thanks for having me back. I really appreciate it.
So have you seen this? I mean, I've been hearing a lot of it lately, especially on social media. But I kind of have this theory that they're trying to get us to change our language to the point where we go, no, democracy. We don't need democracy. Because understand, when I was in school, we were taught that we were a constitutionally limited democratic republic. That's what I learned. And somehow it's morphed down and down to the point where we're just a republic now. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, a couple thoughts. I didn't see the Mike Lee tweet, but I've seen this argument again and again in the last few years. And, you know, it's really just semantics. You know, I mean, if you ask any history professor who's worth his or her salt, they will tell you that the founders, when they drew this thing up, yes, they talked about, America being a republic. But, Benjamin Franklin's famous line, right, a republic if you can keep it. But they saw it as a republic that was powered by democracy, you know, by people voting. And even if some of their ideas in 1789, you know, obviously there were a lot of folks who weren't taking part of that back then. And we worked 200 years plus to fix those defects mostly. But so why are they playing this semantical game? And I mean, I think it's pretty obvious. They want to weaken support for democracy. They want to create a way for people, you know, I think they're smart enough to know that a bunch of people going around saying, "I don't support democracy," if they just said that, that sounds bad, right? But if they start saying, "Well, you know, the founders never really intended us to be a democracy, you know, that they intended us to be a republic," they're trying to sow confusion in people's minds because these people really don't support democracy. You know, they want to roll back a lot of the rights that have been given to women and rights that have been given to African Americans.
Not just a lot, Will. Well, they're telling us they are very clear about their wants. They want to go back to the original intent of the Constitution, which is 3/5 people, women can't vote, only white landowning males, 21 of age, they can vote. They want to go back to the good old days.
They do. They absolutely do. You know, there's one of the people who's involved with this, you know, Project 2025, which I know we're going to talk about, but you know, was out there the other day saying, you know, we really should get rid of that 19th Amendment, which, if any listeners don't remember, that's the amendment that gave women the right to vote in 1920. And you know, or I don't know if you ever heard these clowns, you know, like talking about getting rid of, going back to the pre-1900 system where you don't have direct election of senators, right? You've got the state legislature.
The original intent.
Right. And it's all about this idea that democracy is somehow, it's woke, right? You know, that giving everybody the right to vote in their mind is empowered all these crazy ideas. Well, they're not crazy ideas. I mean, what's empowered is rights for other people who aren't, you know, white, wealthy, cisgender men, you know?
Which is ironic because it was written, you know, all this stuff was written by a bunch of guys wearing wigs. So just want to throw that out there. Bunch of cross-dressers. No, that's not right. But, you know, the thing is, and the reason I think this is important to bring up and to talk about is because I think you're right. We want to make democracy sound evil so that what's coming and this Project 2025 we've been talking about for months now is going to make patronage great again. There's a guy who's running for president whose claim to fame is you're fired. He's running on a platform of we're going to fire all the federal workers and we're going to replace them with good loyalists.
Yeah, you know, if you paid attention in your American history class, you know, you might remember what happened around the 1880s when patronage was out of control. You know, the party would get into power and all the jobs at the custom house and all these places, the post office, would go to their political cronies. And, you know, eventually the craziness over patronage got to the point where a guy who was upset about not getting a job and not getting what he thought he deserved assassinated President Garfield, right, in 1881. After Garfield was assassinated, people said, "Now we need a professional system. We need people to run this government who aren't political hacks, who are subject to the whims of either party." And we created the civil service system. And, right. You know, and we carved out hundreds of political jobs because, of course, you do need some political people to set the direction for the government as established in each election by the people, right? You know, it's like, you know, the New Deal. It's like people in 1932 said, we want the government to do some different stuff. And, you know, so FDR puts his cabinet secretaries and undersecretaries in, but the people who are executing these policies are professionals. You know, the people telling you if there is a hurricane coming are professionals. They're not political hacks, you know, who were putting their job to deny climate change. Right.
Which is why I've been saying, you know, you've got Trump who's running on the idea that we're going to make patronage great again and take us back to the good old days of the 80s and 90s and not the 1980s and 90s. Because I don't know if you've noticed.
The 1880s. Yeah, exactly. And one of the great things about having non-political civil service employees in there is if you tell them to do something that is illegal, they're not inclined to do that, right? You know, it's like, this is wrong and the president's not my guy anyway, and I'm not gonna go to jail because they're ordering me to do this. I'm gonna stand up, you know, in an extreme case, they could become a whistleblower or whatever, but you know, that they're not gonna do that. And this was what happened to Trump a lot of times in his first presidency, hopefully his last presidency, but his presidency from 2017 to 2021 is that he had wacky ideas to do things that were either just bad ideas or in some cases they were illegal. And he would yell at some aide and say, do this. And it would go down the line, like, you know, like the stuff about how they wanted to treat immigrants down at the southern border. You know, you had Stephen Miller yelling at people to do these like cruel and inhumane things down there. And it would get down to the personnel and somebody would say, well, we can't really do this. You know, I mean, that's just wrong. And so, you know, even though some bad stuff did happen, right, like family separation and some other stuff, but what Stephen Miller and these people wanted to do was 10 times worse than what actually happened. So their solution to that is they learned from their experience the first time. And Project 2025 basically is, how do we learn from those mistakes of the first Trump presidency, you know, and by mistakes, I mean, I don't consider them mistakes, but they do, because it was, how do we learn from the radical policies that we talked about, but we weren't able to implement them, even with a simpatico figure like Donald Trump in the White House. So how do we get it done this time? And so people from groups like the Heritage Foundation, which is the lead on this, but also a bunch of other right-wing extremist groups, formed an alliance. And it's like, we're going to start in 2021 or 2022, when absolutely nobody is paying attention to this, and where people aren't even thinking that Trump's ever going to be president again. We're going to sit down and we're going to put this plan on paper, because they know that if Trump does win and he does return to the Oval Office, he doesn't care about governing. He cares about keeping himself out of jail. He cares about graft, you know, he maybe cares about pleasing Vladimir Putin and his friends or whatever.
And he cares about people, you know, yay, we love you, patting him on the back, Rose Garden yeah. ceremonies. He cares about pomp and circumstance. Doesn't care about the nuts and bolts, the sausage making.
Yeah, but the thing is, there is a right-wing community out there that does care about the nuts and bolts, right? I mean, there's these zealots, you know, these people like this Russell Vought, right, who was Trump's OMB director and is one of the big architects of Project 2025, or John McAtee is his unqualified friend who's probably going to be making the personnel decisions in the new White House. I mean, those people do care. You know, a lot of these people are ideologues. They're avowed Christian nationalists or whatnot. And Trump, they know that Trump, who doesn't care about the details, is happy. You know, it's a mutual back scratching arrangement, right? It's like, you know, Trump gets the base behind him by saying, you can have all your little policy things that I kind of support, but don't really care about the details that much. And they support Trump because they know they need a dictator to get these things done. That they know that the majority of the American people, and certainly, I mean, Congress, at least as it's constituted now, you know, doesn't support this stuff, and they need what they call a red Caesar, right? Somebody who's willing to govern as a post-constitutional government, you know, president, where the Constitution needs to be bypassed because they need to crush this liberal fascism of the woke left that they are convinced is happening out there. So it's a real threat. And, you know, I think the average voter isn't seeing it because they'll say, well, you know, Trump was eccentric and crazy and did some really dumb stuff the first time around, but he didn't destroy this country. And they don't realize just how different it will be if he gets elected this time.
But, you know, I think you hit on an interesting point, because a lot of the people that I've explained this to, you know, the idea of making patronage great again, we're just going to put loyalists into positions of just average everyday jobs. The people who are doing the behind the scenes work, the people who are writing reports for whatever, these are going to be true believers, because the first thing they ask for is, give us all your social media information, because we want to make sure you're sufficiently loyal. And giving Trump the ability to then go and fire everybody, replace all them, and basically weaponize government, as they've been screaming about and claiming Joe Biden has done, but doing it in a way that is loyal to dear leader. When you explain that, I get a glazed over look, and people go, that can't happen here. It's almost like we've been programmed to believe, not us, we're Americans. We believe in democracy.
Right, we're conditioned to think that can happen here, and which totally sets up a situation where it could happen here, right? You know, and I think maybe, you know, Democrats or all of us who want to stop this from happening, you know, maybe we should be doing a better job of going out and giving like real world examples of what this means. Like here's one I think people would understand, and maybe it's not the most important life or death thing, but remember that thing when Trump was president, and he said something about hurricane aid in Alabama, but the hurricane didn't go to Alabama. So he grabbed a copy of the map, and he took his little Sharpie, right? And he extended the hurricane map into Alabama. Well, in the second coming of Trump, you know, with this Project 2025 flavored government, he's going to have the civil servant that he can just call, or, you know, his underling can just dial up on the phone, say, release a new map that shows the hurricane going to Alabama, even though it's not.
So basically we're going to have a government full of Winston Smiths, the guy from 1984.
Yeah, exactly. They'll be throwing things down the memory hole. And think about, I mean, these are the people who, you know, the people who believe that elections are rigged and that they can, like, go in and open ballot boxes and that sort of thing. These people are now going to be doing things like releasing the unemployment rate. You know, it's like, what if the real unemployment rate goes up and it's going to make Trump look bad? These people would have no compunction about just changing the numbers, right? A piece I just read today mentioned about how, you know, Trump wanted to monkey with the 2020 census, you know, to make it more friendly for what Republicans wanted to do. Well, you know, for the 2030 census, they'll have the power to make those kinds of changes without having the ability to have it blocked like it was the first time around. So, I think people need to understand, you know, it's hard. I mean, it's, you know, one of the things that I think has been great in the last week about this whole debate that we're having now about Project 2025 is, when you think about it, for the last year, you know, Biden and all the top Democrats have been going out there and giving speeches and saying, you know, democracy is on the ballot this election, or, you know, if you don't vote and if we don't get this right, we could lose our democracy and things like that. And that's absolutely true, but it's also, like, way too abstract, I think, for the average voter, that, like, that doesn't, you know, like, what does that actually mean? What does that mean to my life? You know, I'm worried about, you know, if I'm going to have enough money to fill up with gas this week. You know, what do you mean I'm losing my democracy? I have no idea what that means. You know, and I think, it's funny. Project 2025 has given them a two word catchphrase that they're not just talking about a dictatorship, but they've written it all down, that they have a plan that you can Google.
900 pages of plan.
Yeah, 900 page plan. And, you know, I mean, Biden tweeted today, you know, he tweeted Google Project 2025. I mean, I think you're going to start seeing that on lawn signs, right? It's going to be this catchphrase, you know, and people are going to go on there and they're going to see what they're really talking about when it comes to reproductive rights. Or they're going to see how, you know, gay marriage and these other LGBTQ rights are going to be undone. It's all written out, it's on paper. You know, this whole thing about using the Insurrection Act and calling out the military and sending them into your community to round up, you know, the immigrants who live in our community, who, you know, who work at our companies and keep our construction companies and some of these other businesses going, are going to be taken away by soldiers in the dead of night. You know, I think
The people who read 1984 and saw it as a playbook, the people who read the Ten Commandments and see it as a checklist, these are the folks who they want to be running our government. And that's frightening to me. So last question I've got for you, because we're in this moment, there's a lot of talk on the Democratic side, a lot on the left, saying Biden should go. You know, obviously, you know, nobody on the Republican side saying that someone with Trump's 31, 34 convictions and, you know, all of the plethora of immoral things there. Nobody's calling on him to step down. You got any thoughts?
Well, you know, my paper, the Philadelphia Inquirer, is I think the only major newspaper in the country that wrote an editorial calling on Trump to step down, which is just appalling when you think about it. I mean, I think if you go back to 1998, there were like 100 newspapers across the country. In fact, unfortunately, the Inquirer was one of them, actually, under totally different management. But 100 papers that called for Bill Clinton to resign over the Monica Lewinsky thing. And, you know, the Bill Clinton's conduct, whatever you think of it, was not 100 times worse than what Donald Trump has done. He's a multiple felon. He's an adjudicated rapist. He's been found by a judge and a jury to have committed massive financial fraud. He's been impeached twice, and he's still awaiting trial in three other cases, including a trial for a coup to stop the peaceful transfer of presidential power.
That's his legacy, ultimately. Right. The fact that he's the guy who broke that long, long-standing tradition.
That's right. If you were like staring with your mouth open at the TV at 6:00 p.m. on the evening of Wednesday, January 6, 2021, I mean, could you possibly imagine we'd be where we are right now? I mean, I'm getting ready in a few days to get on a plane to fly to Milwaukee to watch this man, this convicted felon, win a major party's nomination to be the next president of the United States. I mean, it's just utterly insane. And I think we've kind of lost our minds in the sense that we can't verbalize that, vocalize that.
No, I'm right there with you. Will, as always, great stuff. Hope folks will take a look at the amazing work that you do over at the Philly Inquirer. We'll get links out on social media. Will Bunch, thanks so much.
Oh, thanks, Rick. Thanks for having me, Seth.
Our good friend, Will. I want to hear your thoughts. Are you, like Will said, are you surprised that here we are? I'm kind of not, but I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back.
You're listening to WBZH, Hayward's home for the Todd Allbald Show.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. A stray storm or two this evening, otherwise turning mostly clear and lows in the mid-50s tonight. Patchy fog to start Thursday, otherwise we're looking at sunshine and highs in the low 80s. And up into the mid-80s with more sun on Friday. Upper 80s for the weekend, slight storm chance. Currently at 62 degrees.
Busted pencils.
Fully leaded education talk.
Our guest, Jonathan Gurko. Deliberative dialogue and democracy isn't winning an argument.
Instead of how do we win and end the conversation, how do we keep it going? How do I listen in a way on the assumption that someone else has something that I can learn from that will improve my point of view so that we can grow? To me, that's the democratic project.
Busted pencils with Dr. Tim and Dr. Johnny. Weeknights at 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I came across a story from Wisconsin that piqued my interest. As a Dane County judge, a guy named Jacob Frost has issued a decision that 13 years after Scott Walker's Act 10 went into law is now saying, well, we're going to strike part of it down. And that's the part that basically created the division of, yeah, we're going to screw over this set of public sector workers, but, you know, police and fire, they're going to be okay. And what they're saying is, you know, it lacks a rational basis to have that kind of division between the general public sector workers and public safety employees. So we'll see where this goes. But Act 10 was horrible, not just for Wisconsin, but really across the country was the beginning of another assault on workers. And here to share some thoughts on this decision, I've asked our good friend Michael Sonato to come talk with us. Michael's a labor reporter over at The Guardian US. Michael, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on again.
So what do you make of this? I mean, you know, 13 years after the fact, we're now going to say part of it. You're going to strike part of it down. And then how do you make any of those people who have been harmed by this, how do you make them whole or assign any retro? I don't know. What are your thoughts?
My thoughts are it's, you know, a bit of good news in times, especially when we're dealing with courts where, you know, the courts in the U.S. here are very anti-worker. And, you know, not just in Wisconsin, but, you know, across the country, public sector workers especially have been facing union busting at the behest of Republicans. Like, you know, where I am in Florida, a right to work wasn't enough. DeSantis passed the ridiculous law where workers have to basically organize and show that they have a majority support every single year or else their union gets thrown out or they have to hold another election.
Well, that came out of this Act 10 as well. I mean, this was part of what Scott Walker, I mean, to be honest, you know, this was the beginning. This was the playbook that Republican governors and legislatures across the country have picked up and moved forward on. And I remember, you know, we were there in 2011 when the uprising of, you know, 100,000 plus people were in that Capitol. We were sleeping on the floor of that Capitol. And I remember coming back to Pennsylvania and telling, you know, one of the prominent labor leaders here, get ready, because this is, they're packaging this to come across the country. And, well, that guy told me, don't worry about it. We're not Wisconsin. And this stuff spread like wildfire.
Yeah, and you know, a few years later, the Janus decision, you know, obviously that didn't have the impact I think anti-union forces were hoping for, but that kind of really emboldened this, like you said, was kind of the starting point, and it still serves as a playbook for you know, Republicans to pass anti-union laws that undermine and dispel you know, public sector workers, which you know, here in the U.S. that's you know, the unionization density is primarily public sector workers, and it's why those you know, jobs are, you know, good paying jobs. It's why they're highly coveted. But in places where they've gotten rid of that, that's kind of, you know, declined. It's not the same thing, you know, without a union. So,
yeah, I mean, what I find interesting is, you know, you look at this Act 10, which is what we call it all the time. It's, oh, it's Act 10. What the official name is the Wisconsin Budget Repair Bill. And basically what they're telling us is the only way that they could balance their budget is to screw over the workers who work for the state. And it's what they did. I mean, they increased their contributions to their pensions, to their health care. They limited how much of a raise they could get. They really stuck it to public sector workers, limited their collective bargaining rights, ended automatic dues deductions. I mean, and then the annual recertifications, it was so much. And you could argue, well, it helped balance the budget. Yeah, by running a lot of good people out of the state.
Yeah, absolutely. And there were, you know, campaigns, you know, there were a group of nurses, hundreds of nurses at University of Wisconsin Health System that tried to organize in spite of Act 10. And their employer kept saying, no, Act 10 is the law. We're not going to let you do anything. We're not going to bargain with you. And that was during the COVID-19 pandemic. So it was really just giving employers an excuse to not listen to their workers and exploit them and, you know, treat them as expendable. So this had far reaching implications in Wisconsin, you know, for workers, and, you know, emboldened, you know, anti-union forces, you know, not only in Wisconsin. I'm sure it undermined organizing efforts, not only in the public sector, but the private sector as well in Wisconsin. It's hard to quantify how much things like that impact worker organizing. And we talk about declining union density and things, but, you know, these pieces contributed to it. Maybe not immediately, but, you know, a few years down the line with laws on the books like this, it has an effect.
I mean, I have people ask me why, you know, why doesn't labor support Republicans? And why is it such a big deal that Sean O'Brien's going to speak before the RNC? And why am I so opposed to it? I go, look, Republicans have shown us who they are time and time and time again. This Scott Walker thing is a perfect example of that. They limited collective bargaining rights. They did all of these horrible things. The public sector workers also pushed the no rights at work thing. 2015, they passed a right to work law. They ended you know, project labor agreements and the baby bacons, the prevailing wage act stuff. They did all of this stuff to crush wages and to hurt working people. So you go, gee, what could I possibly be in favor of?
Yeah, absolutely. And they carved out firefighters and police unions. So they weren't impacted, which kind of, you know, just takes the mask off on, you know, what they are trying to claim that it was doing. So, you know, the groups that they support, you know, they wrote out of the bills, and they do that in states all over the place where, you know, police unions are exempted from laws like this. They were here in Florida. And That has a bigger conversation on like where police unions stand in the AFL-CIO and the labor movement as a whole when they are silent or condone those types of anti-union policies being implemented.
I gotta tell you though, it was amazing when I was there in 2011 and the firefighters walked in with the bagpipes. It was a moment. And Malin Mitchell was the head of the firefighters union in Wisconsin at the time. And I remember, and he ended up running for governor and lieutenant governor and a couple other things. But I remember that moment of solidarity with the firefighters and them coming in. And that was a pretty impressive moment that I remember. I want to move on real quick because some interesting news coming out of California. Potentially 14,000 workers at Disney. At the Disneyland, or is it Disneyland or World?
Disneyland, Disney World's in Florida.
There we go. So Disneyland, why?
So Disneyland workers, their contract expired last month, and in the midst of negotiations, hundreds of workers were reprimanded for wearing union buttons. Disney said it's against policy. Take them off. They filed unfair labor practices. And so this is an unfair labor practice strike. The vote's next week. The results should be out by the 20th. If they do go out on strike, it's going to be 14,000 cast members at Disney, the largest strike so far of this year. I think there was a hospital system with a few thousand workers earlier this year that went on strike. So definitely would be big for these workers. And a big sticking point is wages. Their last contract was $18 an hour, which is lower than the living wage in Anaheim. The minimum wage, a law was passed that has the minimum wage of $19.90 an hour. And Disney tried to fight that. They lost. They tried to bring that to the state Supreme Court to challenge that rule because they didn't even want to pay that. And now they're using that rule to say, oh, look, the contract, we're improving wages. Well, they already had to. So it's an expensive place to live, expensive, just rent in that area is astronomical. Many workers, have to live far away and commute just to be able to live. They're living with roommates. I spoke with a cashier who was there, who's been there for over 30 years. And she said, when she first started, I could get a 2-bedroom apartment with no problem on the pay they pay you. And today, that's impossible. I think that's, everyone thinks because Disney's so popular and, they do so well that the workers are getting treated right when that's not the case. They've been falling behind in contracts and contracts and contracts over the years. And, the workers are standing up and saying enough's enough.
Yeah. No, it's interesting because I just had this conversation today about inflation and, how upset this person was. And I said, look, the sad reality is wages haven't kept up. If we're the 1970s, like my grandparents, who were both in unions at the time, and their union contracts had automatic cost of living adjustments in those contracts, whereas inflation went up, their wages went up, so their standard of living didn't go down. If we had stronger union density, inflation wouldn't be as big of a deal. So when I hear that you've got these unionized workers who've been working in this job for years and their wages haven't just been keeping up, it's not just them. It's all across the country. And it's one of these things that I'm hoping at some point we actually start making a point out of and complaining a little bit more about or going on strike about.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's important not just for these workers at Disneyland, but they'll set the precedent for other theme parks and for, Disney World workers here in Florida. In Florida, because it's a right to work state, the union strength isn't as great as in California. They do have a no strike clause in their contract here. these workers win at Disneyland will, embolden and set the standard for what Disney World workers and Universal and Legoland and all those places will look forward to. Right now these workers are, working minimum wage and being exploited based on the fact that it is an appealing place to work because, people are fans of Disney, people like the atmosphere. These companies tend to take advantage of that fact.
Yeah, interesting. Well, we'll see how this plays out. Also, I wanted to get your thoughts on the elections coming up. You just put out a story the other day about how Unite Here, the hospitality union is ramping up their political action and getting out there and getting their members to understand how important the election is, as all the unions are doing. Because, the power of the unions, the power of people, and the power of getting them to vote, maybe on things that would make their lives better. Walk me through what you're seeing there at Unite Here.
So Unite Here elected their first female president, Gwen Mills, a few weeks ago. She was the one who kind of developed their 2020 grassroots door knocking strategy, and it was a big deal. It was a big success. They focused on a lot of the swing states that were pivotal in Biden's victory, and by the evidence we have now, their efforts are going to be just as important this year. Especially because, Biden has portrayed himself as so pro-labor, and that's such a staunch contradiction to the Trump administration. People are talking about Project 2025 now. They want to get rid of things like overtime, the very anti-union. Under the Trump administration, they're very, the NLRB was not, a lot of the rules and policies they were implementing were very anti-worker. It was just the industry wish list of what they wanted was getting kind of passed. And it was really putting the labor movement under the defense. In the past few years, it's kind of turned around. So, it poses a big question, and it hasn't really been focused on. I think that's what one of Biden's greatest strengths in this election cycle is, focusing on that support for the labor movement, for workers, the big gains and the victories that have been afforded to workers, like the overtime rule recently.
Yeah. And the heat, regulation that they just came out with. If you're a working person, if you punch a clock for a living, if you got a union card in your wallet, there's no choice in this election. Biden is the guy because he's been on the right side of every issue. Whereas, Donald Trump's running on a platform of we're going to fire all the federal workers and we're going to make patronage great again. I'm struggling, man. I'm struggling to see it. But look, as we looked at Wisconsin 13 years ago and all the stuff that they got away with and did, sometimes I'm just not surprised. But Michael, as always, I appreciate the thoughts, the time. Keep up the great work that you do over there at The Guardian. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Rick.
Good stuff. Michael Sonato, labor reporter there at The Guardian US. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1894. That was the day that labor leader Eugene V. Debs was arrested for supporting the strike of Pullman Palace Car Company workers. In May, the workers who made the popular train sleeping cars had walked off the job. George Pullman had slashed the workers' wages but kept the rents in his company town steady. The striking workers called on Eugene Debs to support their strike. Debs had made a name for himself in the labor movement by successfully founding the American Railway Union. The union joined together railroad workers in an unprecedented force of solidarity across job types. In June, the union voted to boycott Pullman in support of the train car makers. As rail traffic ground to a halt, the federal government moved in to end the strike. federal troops were called out. A federal court issued an injunction against Debs and the boycott. The basis for Debs' arrest was the claim that the boycott interfered with the delivery of the U.S. mail by the trains. Debs served a 6-month jail sentence in Woodstock, Illinois. His case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, which decided in favor of the injunctions. When Debs was released from prison, he delivered a speech he called Liberty. In it, he declared, quote, "The people have seen the money power practicing at every art of duplicity, growing more arrogant and despotic as it robbed one and crushed another, building its fortification of the bones of its victims and its palaces out of the profits of its piracies." The Pullman strike and the American Railway Union were crushed, and injunctions became a powerful tool against the labor movement.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So I got to tell you, you know, my mind is stuck in Wisconsin in 2011. We were sleeping on the floor of the Capitol in February. Cold. I remember very cold. And I'll tell you, it was an amazing moment of activism and an amazing moment of community, and people who wanted to fight for a better life because they understood what Scott Walker was doing at the time. And for those who don't remember, Walker pushed this idea, the budget repair bill, Act 10, which was all about going after the state workers. It was all about, you know, limiting their ability to collectively bargain. It was all about, you know, making it as hard as possible for the unions to be able to represent, for members, for people to join. They even went as the petty stuff of, we're not going to collect the union dues out of your paycheck and give it to the union. The dues check off. We're not going to allow that anymore. And it's literally a code. In a computer costs nothing to do. In fact, you know, when they tried to do it here in Pennsylvania, they were trying, you know, the labor folks at the time were going, well, tell us how much it cost. We'll pay you for it. And they couldn't tell how little it cost. But understand what the point of that all was. It was to limit the ability of workers to fight for better wages, hours, conditions. It was to limit their ability to be a political force. This really was the beginning of the most recent attack. You go back to Reagan and the firing of the Patco workers, the shot heard across the boardroom. This was the most recent iteration of that, where the moneyed interests, and I remember, you know, the billionaire Diane Hendricks, who famously got caught on tape, you know, in one of the most bizarre kind of almost sexual way of going, when do we get right to work? Because, you know, a billionaire concerned that her workers were going to make $1 an hour more. And this is what it was about. It was about power. It was about ensuring that workers didn't have the ability to fight for better wages, hours, conditions, and also to punish. And, you know, I found it interesting at the time that they were going through all this, and everyone knew it was highly, highly partisan, highly divisive. In fact, something they tried to sneak through like thieves in the night, had it not been for a bunch of college students who actually read the bill and understood that it was going to affect them in enormous ways, because it also went and slashed funding for education, which screwed up their education system. So all of the themes that we've been talking about, you know, for the last, you know, 19 years doing this show, you know, Walker put together in one playbook. You go after education, you go after public sector workers, you go after union workers, because eventually they went after prevailing wage laws. Eventually they passed the whole right to work package that comes along, attacked unemployment insurance, attacked workers' comp, all of this stuff to, well, diminish a worker's ability to make lives better. And you fast forward to now, where we've got this inflation that we've lived through the last couple of years, where had you a stronger labor movement, you would have been able to mitigate some of the pain by increasing wages, by saying, look, you know, inflation's going up, wages should go up to meet it so our standard of living doesn't fall. Because we don't ever say we, during hard times, we should be taxing the very wealthy. You never hear Republicans talk about that. So I find it interesting that, you know, we're kind of in this moment again, where it's a which side are you on kind of moment. Are you on the side of working people? Are you a working person yourself? And how these reforms that Republicans keep throwing at us, how they affect our lives, how they harm our lives. You know, and as I said a moment ago, you know, I've had people over the years say, well, why don't you, you know, support Republican politicians? Because, you know, they believe in paying their, you know, budget, balanced budgets, and they believe in America. And I'm going, you know, there are some things that I agree with what they say. Like, I think you do have to pay your bills. I'm right there with you. But they don't ever do it. Oddly enough, when Republicans are in office, they run up higher deficits, more debt. They're worse at it. They're worse at the economy in every metrics possible, except enriching the very wealthy. That they do masterfully. You know, so for me, it's which side am I on? I'm on the side of working people. I'm on the side of when I get my paycheck, is it enough to cover the roof over our head, the clothes on my kids' back, the food on the dinner table? And the sad reality for too many, it's getting harder and harder. So when you got to someone like Joe Biden who's saying, look, we want you to be able to collectively bargain, fight for those better wages, hours, conditions, fight for that wealth that your labor creates. I'm on Team Biden. But I look at my Republican friends. And look, I wish I understood a working person voting against their own economic interest. I wish I got it. And I've had people say, well, you know, it's because of guns, it's because of religion, it's because, you know, whatever, you know, throw the whatever in there. At the end of the day, it's about putting food on your table and keeping a roof over your head. All that other stuff comes from the economic power that you get from having decent wages, hours, conditions. So I just thought it was interesting that, you know, here we are all these years later. This is still something that is there. Now, you know, I remember coming back from Wisconsin because we spent 2 weeks there right at the beginning of the uprising. We were the first radio program to broadcast from within the Capitol. We were in Brett Halsey's office. He was a state representative at the time. And, you know, we got the show out and, you know, we got to interview tons of people. And I remember, you know, coming back going, this is much bigger than just Wisconsin. You look at the complexity of the legislation and all of the targets that they're going after. And it's all of the worker organizations. It's all of the things that working people need, like education and healthcare and all of this stuff. Under the guise of, you know, we need to cut the budget. And what does that mean? That means cutting things for working people. That means cutting the things that you and me and our neighbors need. That's the repair. We got to fix things to where they used to be, which is desperate workers working in deplorable conditions, which, trust me, we're moving back towards quickly. But I remember coming back from Wisconsin, coming back to Pennsylvania and talking to the guy who was the head of the AFL here at the time. And I said, you know, this is big stuff. We should start organizing around the idea that this stuff is coming. And he looked at me and said, you know, that's Wisconsin. Couldn't happen here. And within a year, all of that legislation had made its way. Because understand, we then found out, you know, everyone started to learn who ALEC was, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and how a lot of this stuff was model legislation from them and other right-wing think tanks, and how the game plan here was much larger. The game plan was much better funded than anyone knew in February of 2011. We learned quickly, but it was much larger and much better coordinated. The one thing that the right does, the one thing that the moneyed interest does, when they know there's something they want, you know, your health care, your retirement, your wage increases, you know, any of that stuff, they absolutely, positively, without question, know how to get it. And they come up with cute little euphemistic name groups who, you know, will the Employment Rights Center and all these national, the right to work people. They don't care about you. What they care about is more for their funders, more for the wealthy, and less for you. So this election, it's a big deal. You got one guy who's been, he walked a picket line. He found Obama's comfortable shoes, hit a picket line. You got another guy, he's running on, I'm going to fire everybody. Bizarre times. Bizarre times. Miss any parts or portion of the program? Podcast. As always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
To the Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@therickssmithshow.com.
This is the Buzz of the North. WBZH 910 AM. W245 CT Hayward. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.